This is the bonus section, or the second PM session, for Sunday, July 19th. Again, this is the second session for Sunday, July 19th, the second PM session. If you look on our Bible reading schedule for the month of July, by the 19th, we would have finished all of Ecclesiastes in the in-class at the building session. We got up to about chapter 5. We're going to recap some of those things in the first 5 chapters of Ecclesiastes, and then we will complete a survey using both our Everyday with God class notes and selected passages from the text. We will complete the book of Ecclesiastes, all 12 chapters. So during the class session itself, after we finished reading through the book of Proverbs and covered that and summed it up a little bit, introducing the book of Ecclesiastes, we only had time to hit the highlights using our Everyday with God notes for the first 5 chapters. So we want to go back over those 5 chapters, not reading the notes again, at least not in their entirety, but actually looking at samples from the first 5 chapters from the text that reflect the gist of what's going on in Ecclesiastes to this point. So we noted already that this is a wisdom literature book. There are 5 texts that are generally considered that broad in that broad category: Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon we'll only briefly review at the beginning of our class for Sunday, July 26, and not go into much detail about it. But Ecclesiastes is in that library of 5 wisdom literature books, and it's unique in that much of the Old Testament up to this point is God being the spokesman, addressing to his people or to the patriarchs or through the patriarchs or to his people or through the prophets, messages to the world. But God's the principal speaker, addressing his will, his desire, his expectations for all of humanity in lots of different areas of life. But when we get into the book of Job, and the Psalms especially, and the book of Proverbs, we see other speakers. Not saying that God's out of the picture by any means. God is very much central to Job, especially in the latter part of the book. Very, very much central to what we see in Psalms, as God is often petitioned. But in the wisdom literature, the point of view comes from the perspective of what is usually the audience, mankind, in which the audience, mankind, becomes the speaker. They are the ones who are expressing their wills. They are the ones who are expressing their hearts and their desires and everything that they're experiencing in the context of life, often from a very sour or negative or experiential situation that says, you know, listen, God, do you see what's going on? And so Ecclesiastes is part of that very, very broad subject of wisdom literature. And it's unique in the things that it presents. It's very, very negative. It's very, very dour. It's very, everything's bad, everything's bad, everything's bad. And we cover that in our lesson in the sermon about Ecclesiastes in as part of our Sunday morning series. So Ecclesiastes is a unique perspective. And so it starts off by saying that there's nothing that really counts for anything in life, and you have to take it again in context. Everything is vanity. Now, that does not mean that holding a loved one is vain. That does not mean, you know, grasping someone's hand is vain. It does not mean experiencing the joys of a new child coming to the world is vain. It doesn't mean that rejoicing in a good thing is vain. It's talking about vanity in the confines of talking about the overall broad things that people pursue in life. And so wealth, pursuing that is vain, looking for fame and honor and glory and all kinds of accolades that come in from those around you, that can be vain. So vanity in that context is used in a hyperbolic way to say that the world is so characterized by these vain, futile, useless, empty, not profiting, ultimately pursuits, that it's like everything's that way. But it doesn't mean that, you know, watching a flower grow and harvesting food from your garden, it doesn't mean that those things are vain. But generally speaking, those things are not things that are the focal point of all of life. They don't serve as a superstructure by which everything is governed in life. Everything in life is not governed by watching flowers grow or harvesting crops or holding little babies and so forth. And so the vanity is referring to the general pursuits that most people, not everybody, that most people or many people pursue in life. And so that aspect is part of what the writer introduces in the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes. And so again, we surveyed using our outline notes of the first five chapters. Let's just hit a few passages specifically. After the introductory verse, verse 2, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And so everything's absurd, everything is frustrating, everything is futile, everything is nonsensical. What are we doing? Why are we here? What are we accomplishing in life? That's the introductory idea, or the introductory question, or the introductory claim. And notice you see the word in English translation anyway, in verse 2, appearing in some form at least five different times. Vanity of vanities, there's twice. Vanity of vanities, same thing repeated, so there's four. All is vanity. And so five times there's an emphasis on this is what life is all about. It's futile, it's nonsensical, it's absurd, there's no sense made of all of these things. And then the questions begin immediately after that, that amplify, that expand on the claim that everything's vain. You work all your life, and what do you get out of it? All right, what's a man get? He's going to die, and the next generation's going to die, and everybody's going to die in a lesson that will be delivered on Wednesday night, July 29th, at the North Jasper Church. I'm supposed to speak about baptism, my message in focusing on baptism is going to focus on one particular aspect of baptism, and that's of its connection to death. And so I'm entitling the lesson, "Are We All Just Born to Die?" Well, that's kind of an Ecclesiastes kind of question. You know, all the stuff that we work for in life, we toil and we labor for it under the sun, but you die. But the world is still here. So are we just here to live and then we die and that's it? That's the kind of approach that Ecclesiastes starts with. And so drop down to verse 6. It talks about the wind going to the south and it turns around to the north. There's a cycle. And in this context, it's a vicious cycle. What goes around comes around. What goes around comes around. What goes around comes around. And it's endless. You see that endless cycle of being right in God's sight, drifting away from God, calling out to God, being oppressed by people, having a deliverer, a judge come to their rescue, and then being fine for a while, and then falling right back into it again. There's that cycle constantly, and it just happens all the time. The sun comes up, the sun goes down, it's dark in between, and we live our life or whatever. What's the purpose of life? Everything is just work, and we are not really ultimately satisfied. That thought is brought out in verse 8. What's been in the past is what is now and what will be. And so you've heard the expression before. Those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it. But there is a cyclical sense to history. Yeah, there are some things that are linear in direction. But in this context, it seems to be directionless. And so there's nothing new. Yesterday was just like the day before. And today is just like yesterday, and tomorrow will be the same. And so that, again, is very, very heart-wrenching to talk about these things. So look what we see in verse 13. "I set my heart to seek and to search out my wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven." That's pretty broad. You know, that encompasses the study of absolutely every physical thing, every motive, every thought, that's a huge, huge undertaking. You're studying everything about the physical universe. You're studying everything about life, psychology, sociology, economics, everything. I want to look at all that stuff. And then he says, "This grievous task," notice the language, "this grievous task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised," verse 13. And he doesn't mean exercise in the sense of you're doing push-ups and you get stronger, you're doing sit-ups and you're getting stronger, you're running and getting stronger. He means exercise in the sense of I am exercised and stressed and worn out and afflicted. That's the sense that's brought out here. And so I want to know all of these things. That's my pursuit. That's part of what's driving going on in the book of Ecclesiastes. Well, what am I going to get from this? He says, it's all grasping for the wind. So that sense of vanity and vanities, five times in the opening verse, another way that's expressed in the text is, it's all vanity. It's all grasping for the wind and trying to learn so much, that just increases your sorrow. So that's the positive, and I'm using that with my tongue firmly planted in cheek. That's the positive way that the writer of Ecclesiastes starts. We're not going to get anywhere, but we're going to try this anyway. So the second chapter starts off by speaking about a particular pursuit, a particular goal and objective in life that's going to be demonstrated as part of the vanity of vanities, all is vanity thing. And what is that? Pleasure, joy, mirth, things that please you physically in some kind of sense-oriented way. So he says, this is what I said in my heart. Let me test you with mirth, all right? Mirth simply means gladness, joy, whatever makes you happy. Let's do that. Let's enjoy pleasure. But surely notice he says this also was vanity. What about laughing? There's nothing wrong with laughing, but it's madness and mirth. What does it accomplish? I'm not getting anywhere. To be happy is not the greatest objective in life, because what's the source of your happiness? Is it legitimate? Is it genuine? Is it a happiness that God wants? You know, the merriness that's ascribed to God's people in Scripture, especially in the book of Proverbs that we recently studied, doesn't mean you're happy in the sense that the world looks at happiness. And so here are some of the things that I looked at that brought me pleasure, that brought me joy. I looked at how to gratify my flesh with wine. Okay, yeah, drinking fine wines and enjoying, you know, the taste, the aroma, and all the feelings and whatever. That's what I did. I did that all the time. I looked at all the great things that I built, my houses, my vineyards, and so forth, my gardens, my orchards, all the water pools. So you see, he's speaking from the perspective of somebody who's able to afford all of these things. I acquired male and female servants and had servants that were born in my house. And indicating that he had access to lots of things because of his wealth. I had great herds and flocks. I gathered all the silver and gold and the special treasures of kings. I had singers. I had people playing musical instruments around me. I was great. There was nobody else like me. And I had wisdom. Whatever I wanted, look at verse 10, whatever I wanted, whatever my eyes desired, didn't keep from them. I see it, I like it, I want it, I got it, all right? So my heart rejoiced in all of these things. Then I looked in all the works that my hands had done, verse 11, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed, all was vanity. In the end, living for things or living to possess things, it's not going to be very good at the end, because when you're old and not able to enjoy them, at least not as fully as you did before, and you're facing death, how are those things going to comfort you? You know, hugging all the things that you've bought, that you've possessed, that you've owned, that you've cultivated in all your treasures, whatever, hugging those things and holding on to them is not going to prevent you from dying. And when you do die, none of those things will be there with you. They are things. Man's life does not consist of the abundance of things that he possesses. So says Jesus in Luke chapter 12, verse 15. So that's all vanity. That's just vain. Well, he's not done. So he says, well, I turn next to finding out everything I could learn. All right, that's part of his objective in the end of chapter 1, verse 18. I turn to considering wisdom and madness and folly. And, you know, this is what I'm going to pursue next. And he says, wisdom's greater than folly, just as light excels darkness. But guess what? The wise man dies, just like the fool dies. So what did I gain by pursuing the excellency of wisdom? I'm still going to die. You might say, well, at least he was wise during the course of his life. And though he died like the fool dies, he wasn't a fool while he was alive. But ultimately, it did not separate him from the fool in that both died. So, and that's what he says, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. Verse 15, so why was I more wise? What did I gain over the fool? It didn't exempt me from death. For there's no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. You know, at some point, men die. Even famous men die while they were alive, and though their fame may continue for a while, it's not going to continue forever. Oh, there are some exceptions in the context of history. In our particular history, we remember great statesmen and presidents of the past, you know. But most people, they fade from our memories. So what's his response to all this? Verse 17, I hated life. Why? Because everything that was done under the sun was grievous to me, and all is vanity. And the second way that he reflects that, grasping for the wind. Saw that in verses 16 and 17 of the first chapter. Grasping for the wind. You can't grab hold of the wind. It gets away from you. You never really can hold on to it. Never hold on to it at all. Not just not really. And so what's the point of all that? Everything that I've worked for, I'm going to leave to the next person. My son, my family, my heirs. And what's he going to do with it? He worries about that. Verse 18, I'm going to leave it to the man who comes after me. And is he going to be a wise man or is he going to be a fool? He's going to rule over all my labor in which I told and which I've shown myself wise under the sun. He gets it. I'm going to worry about all that stuff. What's it going to do? It's vanity. You cannot affect, you cannot change what's going to be done by those who are your heirs. It's vanity. And so, you know, he's going to leave this to a man who hasn't worked for it. That's vanity. It's a great evil. The man's days who pursue these things are sorrowful. His work is grievous. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. It's vanity. There's nothing better for a man that he should eat and drink and provide for himself. And this he saw from that was from the hand of God. So there's a glimmer. Watch this. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. And that is, you see the darkness of everything presented in the opening chapters and indeed in most of the book. There's a brief light. Well, I can feed myself and I can take comfort in the fact that the labor that I did to feed myself and taking care of my daily needs, that was okay. That was from the hand of God. But accumulation of all these things, the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of things that are not so mundane, feeding oneself, those things, you know, they're vain. Now you might say, well, you can feed yourself every day, 3 times a day, 100 times a day, whatever, you're still going to die. But there's a simple blessing that's involved in that, and that you're sustained from one moment to the next simply because of the bounties that God has allowed the earth to produce. So we look in chapter 3 next. We alluded to this at the beginning of last time, or in the course of our lesson last time, in the PM session, the in the building, in place session, that the first 8 verses had been turned into a song made popular in the 60s by the musical group The Byrds. That's B-Y-R-D-S. And he said there's a time for everything. There are seasonal things that happen, of course, weather-wise, in the course of a year. You know, spring, summer, winter, fall, and so forth. And they change depending on where you live on the surface of the planet. But there are also seasonal things in the context of life. There's a time for every purpose under heaven. Time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pick up. And so some things become somewhat important, less than vain, in the context of going through this cycle of things. And so there are some things, but notice none of these things have anything to do with the vain pursuits that were introduced in chapter 1 and in chapter 2. These are the most mundane of things that he speaks about. So after he introduces that, verses 1 through 8, he raises the question again. I'm going to get old and I'm going to die, and what did I gain from my labors? Brought out the same thing in chapter 2. What profit has the worker from what he labors? I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. Notice God-given. God's made everything beautiful in his time. He's put eternity, some kind of reflection of that which is eternal into the hearts of men, except no one can find it out, but God does from the beginning, unless, of course, God reveals himself. Notice, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. There's a hint of the glimmer of things. It's okay that I can sustain myself with food that I've labored with my hands to produce. That's an okay thing. So in the context of all of vanity, that's not a vain thing. The context of realizing it's good to do good, that's okay. Also, that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. That's a gift from God. That's the second time he's brought out that specific thing. But then the other about doing good's fine. Now he says, I don't understand everything that God wants to be done, has done and will do. I know that whatever God does, it's going to be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. So focusing on God-related things, simple, you know, daily, mundane, provisional blessing things that aren't part of man's pursuit for greater things for his own glory. That's okay, doing things that honor and glorify God, even these easy, simple things, basic things that sustain life, that's an okay thing. But generally, most people don't build their life around just enjoying the bread that they eat and the crops that they yield. They want bigger things. They want better things, all right? So he's concerned about that. Notice also he's concerned about judgment and wickedness and sin that exists. In verse 16, that's a moral perspective that's more extensively developed in Proverbs and in the prophets. As we continue our study in the book of Isaiah, we'll see even more about that. So everybody's going to be judged, ultimately, the righteous and the wicked. So again, the fool and the wise, they're going to be dead, and the righteous and the wicked are going to be done. Everybody's going to be judged. So there's no advantage from one perspective in that everybody's going to be judged, though there is, in the overall context of Ecclesiastes and the Bible as a whole, an advantage to being righteous. Notice, concerning the estates of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. Some people's life are nothing more than going through instinctive desires like animals. Now, he's not saying they are beasts, but they are like beasts. They are behaving as they are. Same sort of things brought out in 2 Peter. They're like natural brute beasts. They're thinking only of self. They're thinking only of things that they can accomplish for their benefit, instinctive things that feed self rather than glorify God. And so notice this, whatever happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. The fool dies, the rich dies. The poor dies, the rich dies. The fool dies, the wise dies. And in this context, we die just like the animals die. What's different between us? Surely they all have one breath. Notice, man has no advantage over the beast. Now he's again speaking from this very, very negative, you know, absurdist point of view. Man has no advantage over the beast in that they all die. So that's vanity. And so we're not any different than them. And there are, of course, people who buy into that from the standpoint of this particular species, mankind, Homo sapiens, is no different ultimately and thus no better ultimately than any other species on the surface of the planet. Well, he's not writing from that kind of evolutionary, naturalistic, material philosophy, but from the standpoint of this dies, that dies, bugs die, people die, animals die, they're all dead. There's no advantage then. So who understands what we are really about? They all go to one place, verse 20. They're all coming from the dust. They're all going back to the dust, ashes to ashes, dust to dust thing that we see in the latter chapter of Ecclesiastes. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, interesting, and the spirit of beasts, which goes down. So there's an assumption that there is some distinction afterwards, and that's not fully developed. I perceive that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, not talking about, you know, things that are grandiose and in the pursuit of pleasure and wealth and all that kind of stuff, focusing on simple things. Again, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Again, we're reviewing the details about the chapters that we introduced before, the first five, and then we'll take up after that and continue throughout the rest of the book. Chapter 4, again, continuation of just endless pessimism, it seems. Every aspect of life, every street that you walk down in life, is just everything that you experience that's not going to be God-oriented, God-designed, is going to be doubtfully valuable. And there's, I'm questioning this. I doubt these things. And so, again, it's just vanity of life. So let's look. He says, I return and consider all the oppression that's under the sun. So there are lots of things that are negative. And there's the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter, again, from his perspective. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, but they don't have comfort. I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Why? They don't have to deal with what we're dealing with. They are exempt from this because they're dead. Doesn't consider the state of the dead from the standpoint of what they may or may not be experiencing. But from his perspective is they don't have to go through this anymore. At least they don't have to deal with the troubles of life. All right. So more than the living who are still alive, yet better than both is he who has never existed. Ah, there's an interesting perspective. So the dead don't have to deal with the junk that I'm dealing with in life. But, you know, those, and it's an imaginary those, because he says they never existed. Nobody, they didn't have to face anything ever. these imaginary, ephemeral, just conceptual beings that never came into existence, they didn't have to face stuff in life. Remember, Job says, I wish I was never born. All right, I wish I died when I was a child. I wouldn't be experiencing this stuff. So the assumption is, if you're dead, you don't have to go through the guff that you're going through in life. It's going to be better. And if you never existed, even better than that, because you never experienced anything. So dead, not dealing with what's going on now, but with those who are living. And so there's a betterness to being dead, because you're not dealing with present difficulties. But there's an even betterness to those who never existed, because they don't experience anything. Why? They never existed. They're only conceptual. They're not real. And so again, you know, that's a very negative thing. Better to be dead than alive, because the dead aren't dealing with the realities of life. And even better than that would be never have to come into existence, because you don't deal with things even temporarily. Having dead come to the point of dying and not dealing with them now, just you never dealt with them at all. So what's his point? It's all vain. It's all vain. Verse 4 and following, all toil and every skillful work a man does is envied by his neighbor. So if you succeed, you excel in some way. Somebody's surely going to be upset about it and jealous, envious of that. That's also vanity and grasping of the winds. And so, you know, focus on those things that are going to be better than focusing on things that are less than better, that is being jealous of the other's good work. Another brief glimpse of light. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full together. That's a proverb-like thing that we saw in the book of Proverbs. Then both hands fold together with toil and grasping for the wind. So be satisfied with what you have, the sense of contentment. Philippians 4, Paul talks about that. So again, he talks about more vanity, verse 7 and following. The people who want everything, never satisfied with riches. All right? Value of friendship, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. If one falls, one can lift them up. But woe to him who's alone when he falls. So their friendship. Well, you can't put a value on friendship. It's not something you buy. It's not something you accumulate in the sense of things, but it's a relationship, and relationships are, of course, very important. All right, the last part of the chapter, it talks about the vanity of being known, well-known. He says, that doesn't do you any good either. Everybody knows who you are, you're still going to die. Famous people die, even those who are very, very well known. Chapter 5, the last chapter we introduced, and the last one we'll just touch on by not looking at our notes. He says, draw near to hear rather than give the sacrifice of fools, for they don't know that they do evil. So notice, go to the house of God. Go prudently to the house of God. So again, in the midst of what is generally a doom and gloom, you know, absurd, senseless text to this point, and in large measure overall, till we get to the very end of the book, there are some glimpses of light. Some more proverb-like statements. Be careful of what you say. Don't speak rashly. Don't speak hastily. Just be quiet. Let your words be few. Again, that could be straight out of the book of Proverbs. So you see a lot of proverbial statements that are brought out here. If you make a vow to God, make sure that you pay it. Don't promise something and then not live up to that. Don't do that before God. Don't do that before anybody. Be careful about speaking a lot. In the multitude of dreams and many words, there's vanity. I want to do this and I want to do that. Got that. Sometimes we are guilty of that, myself included. This is what I want to do. Are you going to do it? I don't know. Well, just be careful about the vainness of that sort of thing. Notice verse 8 and following. You see the oppression of the poor and violate perversion of justice and righteousness in a province. Don't marvel at the matter, for high official watches over high official and high officials over them. There's a hierarchy there. Moreover, his point is, you know, if you see that, we're going to see this in Proverbs, do something. You know, you see something, say something is the model that we often hear today. But in the context of dealing with the oppression of others, you need to speak up. And so make sure you do that. Verse 10 and following, again, warning about the dangers of wealth and those who love substance, those who seek it. What's he say about it? It's vain. It's vain. When your goods increase, they increase who eat them. And so a lot of people are going to come looking for you. If you become wealthy, they're going to consume your goods for you. The sleep of a laboring man, verse 12, is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. you know, you've got everything you want, but he's got some difficulties going to sleep. There's some psychological, emotional things that are going on there. All right, so general warnings against things. Look at the language that we see that brought out the same thought before in verses 14 and 15. A man has a son, nothing in his hand. What's he going to do with the riches that he gets? That's an issue that came before. He comes from his mother's womb, and he's going to naked return to the earth to go as he came. He's not going to take anything with him. Paul reflects on that when he wrote Timothy. That's a severe evil, that they come into this world just the way everybody else does, and they leave the same way that everybody else does as well. So notice again the simplicity of pursuing easy things, simple things, I shouldn't say easy things, basic things, fundamental things, singular-minded things. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink to enjoy the good of his labor. All right? So that's a gift of God. That's third or fourth time at least that that has been brought out. All right, so we want to review the rest of the book, and we'll hit our notes first and then come and look at the chapter itself, so our Everyday with God notes. In the sixth chapter, Solomon turns his attention to the vanity of riches and honor. We've seen some of that before. We're going to see some more of it. For all of a man's effort, he must one day realize that his ambition and his desire will be frustrated if he seeks such things only for the present. So I've got what I need today, and I've got enough for tomorrow, and maybe multiple tomorrows. I may have enough so I could stop working. I've got everything that I need. Got it. That's okay. But what about beyond that? Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Timothy 6, I just alluded to this, alluded to what we see taught in the fifth chapter by the book of Ecclesiastes, pleasures of the earth remain here. When we leave the earth, they're still here. All right, when we die, what's the purpose then of attempting to gather so much during this life? Riches must be taken in proper perspective, just like everything else. Riches aren't sinful in and of themselves, but the pursuit of riches solely for the purpose of getting riches, that's the wrong attitude. All right, Solomon of all men, and if he is not the exact author, and there's questions to that, we introduced that very briefly in our introduction, but men like Solomon knew what it was like to possess lots of physical treasures and to be able to buy whatever they wanted. But the statement here is made that that's vain. That's vain. So let's look at chapter 6 and hit a couple of highlights. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, he doesn't lack anything. He's got everything he desires, but he can't consume all of it because he has so much. A foreigner is going to consume it. So, and the point is, somebody can take that from you. He's worried about the next generation, what they're going to do with it. He's worried about people taking it while he's alive. All vain, all vain. If he has 100 children, verse 3, and he lives many years, so the days of his years are many, but his soul's not satisfied, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. Whoa! That's the Job thing that we see. Man that is born of woman is few days and full of trouble. I wish I was never born, or I wish I would have died when I was a child. I wouldn't be experiencing this. So if you have hundreds of children, you'll have a long time, but you're not satisfied, you might as well have been a stillborn child. What's the point? Stillborn children don't have to experience all this vanity, all this emptiness and absurdity. And so you might say, that's just a very, very negative perspective. Indeed, it's intended to be a very negative perspective. Again, notice if he lives 1,000 years twice over, but he hasn't seen goodness, doesn't he die like everybody else? All go to one place. They all die. Labor of man, he's not satisfied. What has he gained more than the fool, the wise man? Nothing. All right, they both die. They both die. Notice verse 9, vanity grasping for the wind. Vanity grasping for the wind. And so there's a difference. There is no difference between the rich and the poor, the wise and the fool, those who have everything and those who have nothing. They all are going to die. All right, look at the last verse of chapter 6. For who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Well, you know, nobody's experienced that. And again, under the sun means while you're alive. While the sun's shining, and you see the sun shining. When you're dead, you don't see the sun shining, so you're not under the sun. So under the sun means during the course of this life. I've seen all of these things under the sun in the course of life, which is a tacit admission that I don't know anything about what's not under the sun. And that doesn't mean when the sun's not shining or nightfall. It means when I'm not living. I don't know what goes on in the realm beyond this realm. right? I don't know that. So he's speaking from a limited perspective. Same kind of thing that we see in the book of Job, Job and his friends are all speaking from the perspective that they had. They can't speak from God's perspective. Why? They don't share that perspective. They're not God. They weren't where God was, when God was, in all the things that he did. Something God brings out repeatedly with reference to creation. Where were you when I... And then he speaks about some creative thing that happened. That's something that he did at the beginning of the physical earth, and nobody was there. So that's outside of the perspective. Even though it was under the sun from the standpoint of happening physically, when the sun came into existence and so forth during the creation week, those things were happening physically, but they weren't there to experience that. So here, the writer is speaking about the vanity of worrying about all these things, knowing that I have a very limited perspective. I only see what can be seen. I only know what can be known. I can't speak about the things I don't see, but I can worry about them. I can wonder about it. All right, chapter 7. Looking at our notes, Solomon, again, the writer discusses the counsels of prudence, you know, not jurisprudence, law, but, you know, being wise in one's decisions, being discerning. The counsels of prudence in a world that's corrupted by sin. He cautions men to choose what's better. Approving the excellent is the way the Philippian writer Paul says to the church at Philippi, chapter 1, verse 10. He teaches that wisdom is more valuable than wealth, and indeed Proverbs teaches that repeatedly. He contrasts asceticism. Asceticism is dealing without not being connected to the things in the world. You know, taste not, touch not, that philosophy that's brought out in Colossians chapter 2, and just removing yourself from the physical possessions in the world as a whole. So we contrast asceticism with excess, and, you know, but in the end, both are going to die. He speaks of the value of wisdom as it relates to the wickedness of folly. And again, they're still both going to die. With regard to prosperity, you must remember that righteousness doesn't guarantee wealth, nor does wickedness necessitate poverty. In fact, one of the oft-made claims in Scripture by those who claim to be God is, they're righteous and others aren't. How come we don't have what others do have? And that's a big thing in Malachi. You know, why should we do your will? We're not getting anything out of it. Those people over there are not doing your will, and they got everything. All right, they have everything. So the degree to which a person is righteous or wicked doesn't have anything to do with what he does or doesn't have, with whatever wealth or possessions that he has. Notice again, glimmers of hope. It's better to have a good name than a precious ointment. And the point is, reputation is better than the most expensive of things that you can buy. All right, but notice the negativity of this, the day of death better than that of one's birth. Why would he say that? Again, you're not suffering the stuff that you're dealing with in life if you're not living. Better to go in the house of mourning than to go in the house of feasting. That's an interesting perspective, because ultimately everybody's going to be there in the end. That's the end of all men, verse 2. So notice again, negative slant to everything. Sorrow is better than laughter. By a sad countenance, the heart's made better. So go through that experience of sorrow. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. Heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. Now, that's a general truism that you're going to see, a proverb, aphorism, like what we see in the book of Proverbs. This whole chapter's got a lot of good things in it. Better to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. So listen to people who know what's going on. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. Because lots of people start things, not everybody finishes things. It's better to be patient than to be proud. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. Verse 12, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it, not the money that it might yield. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. It's okay to be thankful that you have what you have, but don't turn against God when you don't have what you formerly had. I remember Job said, you know, God gives, God takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord, and all of these things. Job didn't sin, didn't curse God. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. God hasn't changed. Circumstances might change. You might change in regard to those circumstances, but God hasn't changed. And so make sure you focus on what's going to be truly important. Let's see. Look at verse 20. This is reflected in 1 Kings 8 and Romans chapter 3. There's nobody who's perfect. Not a just man on earth who does good and doesn't sin. Everybody sins. Pursuit of wisdom. Saw that already. We see it again in verse 25. All right. Notice concluding verse, God made man upright, verse 29, but they sought out many schemes. So that's not the way God made them. That's not what God intended to be. Again, God says, here's where you are, here's where you need to be moved. So here's where you are. I made you this way to be upright, but you've moved away. You've sought out many schemes. So that model is brought out everywhere in Scripture. Chapter 8, Solomon speaks about expediency, that is, things that are going to lead to some good, better good, and in an imperfect world. He teaches that authority is to be accepted, that the wicked can be judged, and that there are injustices in life. You know, it's there. It's always going to be there. He also mentions it's impossible to know all the ways of God except what God reveals about himself, the unsearchable riches of God. Romans 11 addresses that. This is, notice he talks about being obedient to authorities, verse 2. That's part of what you need to do to be obedient to God. Romans chapter 13 addresses that. Let's see. We can't keep ourselves alive, verse 8. Excuse me, nobody has the power to do so when they're facing death. Verse 9, have seen, applied everything they could in every work under the sun, that is, during this life. Notice verses 10 and following, saw the wicked buried. They had come and gone from the place of holiness. They're forgotten. That's vanity. Sinner does evil. 100 times his days are prolonged. But, you know, those people who do well before God, fear him, they're going to die. Interesting thought in verse 11, because you don't see justice immediately brought about in the context of justice being needed. You assume that these people did evil, they got away with it, nothing's ever going to happen to them. Well, maybe not now, but all of those things will be resolved at the end of time in judgment. Notice there's vanity that occurs on the earth. There are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked, and the wicked man to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. Good things happen to bad people, bad things happen to good people. What about it? That's a vanity thing. Vanity things. So he says, well, let's just enjoy what we got. Eat, drink, and be merry. You can do that for a while. But, you know, that's not the only thing that you should live for. Verse 17, last verse, I saw all the work of God that a man cannot find out the work that's done under the sun. So God sees everything that's not under the sun. He sees everything. We see what's under the sun in life. But I see God's hand in this. For though a man labors to discover it, he's not going to find it. Moreover, although a wise man attempts to know it, he's not going to find it. We won't know what God knows. Again, that's a Job thing in the concluding, all of the book of Job up till God speaks. Chapter 9, ninth chapter, Solomon states one more time that we must make the best of this life. Death is inevitable, regardless of righteous or evil, good or evil. We're all going to die. We should therefore enjoy life while we can, but not solely for the purpose of enjoying life, but because we must learn to be content. Paul learned that, and he expresses that in Philippians chapter 4. Writer sets forth in this chapter some basic principles for a living which all mankind should follow. In the last section of the chapter, he states that wisdom is better than strength, but you can also pursue wisdom for selfish, ill-gotten purposes as well. All right, notice again, everything occurs alike to all. Verse 2, one event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, the unclean, to him who sacrifices and those who don't. As is the good, so is the sinner. What's the point? They die. They all die. There is the same thing under the earth, under the sun. What happens to one happens to all. The hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts. They're going to die. And those who are righteous, they're going to die. Notice, a living dog is better than a dead lion, which is an interesting twist on things. The living know that they're going to die, but the dead know nothing. And so that's an interesting perspective. It's a value to knowing you're going to die. Earlier he said it'd be better to be stillborn because you're not experiencing these things. And it's better to have never lived at all. So there's a little bit of contradiction in what's going on here. The beauty of enjoying family relationships, husband-wife relationships, verse 9. Interesting perspective in light of the fact that much of what men pursue is vain. He says, whatever you're going to do, do it with all your might. There's no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. So you might as well do it now. So there's a sense in which that's a positive thing. There's a sense in which it's negative. It's positive in that if you're going to do something, do it well. But it's negative in the sense of you're still going to die. You know, it doesn't keep you from dying. All right. Time and chance happen to all. Man also does not know his time, how long he's going to be here or when he's going to die. It suddenly comes. Wisdom is superior to lack of wisdom. Okay, looking to see. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard rather than the shout of the ruler of fools. So be careful about how you express yourself. Chapter 10. Solomon, again, the presumed writer, the conventionally understood writer, teaches that life is uncertain, that is, life itself, and that folly is the cause of ruin. Generally speaking, wisdom is to be preferred above folly. You saw that already in prior chapters. And 12 and following, he states that empty talk is the product of the foolish. All right, so let's see if there's anything that changes. Look at the incredible illustration in the beginning. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment. So he's created this incredibly expensive ointment, whatever, but there are dead flies in it. And so that ruins everything. So, you know, the one rotten apple spoils the whole bunch thing. It's ruined everything. So does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. And so you can upset your wisdom and your honor by engaging in some things that are foolish. Let's see. If you dig a pit, and the assumption is you're digging a pit for others to fall into it, verse 8, you might fall into it yourself. That's a thought that's brought out in the early chapters of Proverbs. Those people who are laying snares and traps for others may be ensnared and trapped themselves. Let's see. Interesting proverb. If the axe is dull, can imagine that the knife isn't sharp, and one does not sharpen the edge, he's going to have to use more strength. But wisdom brings success, and so there's no successful advantage to working with a dull axe or a knife that's less than it should be sharp. But wisdom provides that edge that you need. Okay, a serpent's going to bite and is not charmed. A babbler's no different. So watching what you say, somebody who hasn't mastered their tongue may be like a serpent that bites. Fool's lips are going to swallow him up. Verse 12, again, these are very Proverbs-like things. A fool multiplies his words. He just talks a lot. The interesting thing he brings out in verse 19, he says, money answers everything. Well, that's kind of flies in the face of everything he mentioned earlier about the folly of having wealth, because wealth doesn't give you anything ultimately beyond this life. And even all the things it provides for you in this life are vanity, absurd, grasping for the wind. But there's a sense in which it's assumed that money answers everything. If only I had more money. Well, you could still be in a miserable situation. You could still be a miserable person. You could still be far less than satisfied or happy from God's perspective, even from your own perspective. And so it answers everything in a limited perspective. All right, chapter 11. Of the book of Proverbs. 11th chapter, the writer talks about how to invest in life, enjoins the practice of charity. The book of 1 Corinthians says, do all these things, loving in the process. In the concluding verses, he admonishes the young to remain faithful to his creator. That sets the stage for what we see in the 12th chapter. Let's see. If you worry about what's going on, physical signs, the wind, you might not sow. You're watching the clouds, you might not reap. So you do what you need to do, and don't let. This does not mean you don't plant according to weather, meteorological cycles, but don't be so consumed about things that you get nothing done. You don't know the way of the wind. You don't know the works of God who makes all things. There are some things that are because they are. God made them that way. We don't explain and understand all of those. In the morning you sow your seed. Evening you don't withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper. The point is, there are a lot of things in life that you do that don't yield what you think they're going to do. So what's the most important thing? You can't second guess everything. You can't time the market. You can't time the seasons and so forth. There are things that are outside of our control. And so you need to live in such a way that you're going to be content. All right. And so you don't know what decision first decision, second decision, third decision, which one's going to prosper? And so you don't know. They both look good to me. Which one's the one to choose? Well, I don't know. And so there's a sense of being content in the context of making decisions. Notice God's going to bring all the decisions that you make to judgment. So in the meantime, remove sorrow from your heart, verse 10. Put away evil from your flesh, verse 10. For childhood and youth are vanity. You might say, well, I see children enjoying themselves. Yeah, but you know, you're not always going to be a child, and a child is not facing reality that he's later going to face. I'm saying it's not real to the child, but it's not the full scope of things. You know, they are learning, they're growing, they're developing, they're maturing. And so there's a sense in you don't want to be where they are throughout the rest of your life. Children that don't grow physically, mentally, spiritually, whatever, you know, something's wrong. And so it's an appropriate thing at that time, but it's not the most appropriate thing at all times for all people, because you've got to grow beyond that. That's the whole gist of what we see in the book of Hebrews. You're still children. You are still drinking the milk of the word and haven't grown to the point that you can chew on the meat of the word. And so there's a sense of vanity. That's where some people stay, and children don't stay there. Then the last chapter, and there's much more, of course, can be said about all of these things, everything that we're doing in the context of our reviews, but we're just hitting the highlights. Chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, last chapter, the writer speaks about vanity and the fear of God. He presents an injunction, that is, there's a demand here, you need to act this way. He presents an injunction to listen to what he's got to say. Everybody needs to live for God and not for the vanities of life. He concludes the chapter in the book by teaching we must live life in the light of, that is, in the view of eternity. Back in chapter 3, God's placed eternity in our hearts. There's something in us that has the residue of an eternal God. Only then will life lose the vain aspect which so often accompanies it. Only then will life have the purpose which God intended. So life has true meaning when it's lived as God intended. All the pursuits that are vain are vanity. Pursuit of wealth and mirth and joy and privilege and possessions and power and accolades from everybody and wisdom for the sake of wisdom alone, not for the sake of honor and glorifying God. That's all vanity. So what's the conclusion? Fear God and keep his commandments. That's the whole of man. That's our one's entire responsibility. All right. The last few verses, starting in 6, remember your Creator. All right, before you die, because you can't do so afterwards. Dust is going to return to the dust. The spirit's going to go back to God who gave it. And vanity of vanities to this point is all vanity. So how does he end? He says, this is the way to end. Verse 13, fear God, keep his commandments. That's the whole of man, the whole responsibility of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it's good or whether it's evil. So focus on what is going to be pleasing to God in the end. Well, that completes our more thorough chapter review. Again, when we looked at these things Sunday evening, July 19th, we reviewed only looking at our class notes, Every Day with God notes, through chapter 5. So we actually went through the chapters at a time. One at a time, through chapter 5, and then read through the notes for the rest of the book, 6 through 12, and then looked at examples from that. I'm going to use our class notes and the review on the book of Ecclesiastes as we wrap up this session. So in the book of Ecclesiastes, we see addressed lots of different purposes that men go after in life. Wisdom, pleasure, treasures, power, all kinds of other things. And the bottom line is that all of those things end up being worthless in and of themselves, standing by themselves. They are not the be-all, end-all. They're not the summum bonum, the greatest good that we should pursue. Wisdom by itself doesn't measure up to what God intends it to be, nor does pleasure, nor does wealth, nor does power. All of those things from the standpoint of eternity are worthless because they focus on here and now under the sun. And a view like that's taken into consideration. When a man's living in proper respect for God by keeping his commandments, he's fulfilling his whole duty. In that respect, only in that respect, does life become worth something ultimately, which means beyond the borders of birth and death. It's going to count for something on the other side. right? Apart from true obedience to God, life doesn't have any value. It's only illusions, right? Though the book seems to be incredibly pessimistic in its initial outlook, it closes on a high note. And the high note is seek God, obey God. Seek God, obey God. From that perspective, we can see why it closes this way. Compared to all these other pursuits, this is best, all right? Notice the number of times that something was said to be vanity. Everything's vanity, vanity, vanities, vanity, vanities, everything's vanity. 5 times in the second verse, all right? Those things were vain, absurd, useless, worthless, not going to count for anything on the grander scale. And the grander scale means in the context of considering us in view of eternity. So in our own lives, we need to be sure that we're not caught in the rut of falling after those things that are vain, all right? What are those things vain? Just read through the book of Ecclesiastes. They tell us what they are. We don't want to invest in those at the expense of losing something that's more important. And the more important thing is the relationship of Father, Son, and Spirit. True faith, true discipleship, true Christianity focuses on what we see at the end of the book of Ecclesiastes. It's not a New Testament book, but that's a New Testament principle. Fear God and keep His commandments. It's an Old Testament principle. It's a God principle. It's an everywhere in the text principle. Why? Because God says, I want you to be like me. I want you to be like me. So Ecclesiastes teaches us worldly pursuit. Food from the perspective of the world alone is vanity. Events of the present only have significance as they're related to how they're going to impact us on the other side of life. What you do today, if it only does something for you today and tomorrow in the context of life and doesn't do anything from the perspective of what's going to happen before or on the other side of life, then it can be vain. And God judges on the basis of life and conduct. Not just the things you've accumulated, but what have you done in life that's benefiting now and in the future. If that message were more openly declared to the world, we'd have an easier job of converting the lost. Far too many people are materialistic because they focus on stuff that benefits them now and not tomorrow and beyond tomorrow, beyond the grave. That sort of attitude and outlook, it's hard to teach them about the promises of eternal life because we live in this confines of space and time. I live in this particular place. I live in this particular time, but God transcends that. God's without body, without form. He's eternal. So we need to focus on where God is and what it takes to be where God is. And when I speak about where, I mean being like Him to get where, that is there, where God is. From that standpoint, and only from that standpoint, must we view our lives. The treasures of earth pale in significance when compared to the eternal glories of God. God's permanent, but the stage that we are at this earth is temporal. Everything's going to be redone. So we need to focus on what Solomon says at the very end. Matthew 6, Jesus spoke about food, clothing, shelter, and he said all of those things need to be viewed from God's perspective. Well, I need food, got it. Need clothing, got it. Need a place to stay, got it. And he says from the perspective of God, those things are essentials, but seek God first, and those things will be provided for you. So there's a sense in which Solomon, the extended description of all those things that are negative, vain, fits right into what we see Jesus speaking about. Yeah, focus on those things, but in light of eternity, focus on those things that are going to be more eternity-oriented. God, His kingdom, and righteousness. All right, that sums up where we are for the reading through Sunday, July the 19th. We completed our survey of the book of Ecclesiastes. Sunday morning, we will very briefly cover Song of Solomon and then get into the book of Isaiah. And that's Sunday morning that's coming up, which is the 26th of July.